Welcome to another edition of the INSS English Podcast. I'm Owen Alterman, a former research fellow here at the Institute and now senior international affairs correspondent at the international news channel i24 News. With me today is Dr. Emily Landau, senior research fellow at INSS and head of the INSS Arms Control and Regional Security Program. On our agenda today, we'll talk about the key issues in Emily's area of specialty, of course, those being Iran, and we'll get to North Korea towards the end. Emily, it's great to be back with you.
It's wonderful.
I loved working with you here at the Institute. As you know, I saw you and see you as a mentor, and it's a terrific honor to be back with you and back with the Institute on today's podcast.
Well, it's great for me too.
So let's jump right into it. This is a big summer and a big fall in the course of the saga of the Iran nuclear deal. Of course, in May, U.S. President Donald Trump pulling the United States out of the deal, a first wave of sanctions imposed in August, and the clock is ticking down to November 4th when those next set of sanctions comes into effect, particularly on oil and banking after November 4th. Emily, how's it looking for the administration?
So far, I think the pressure campaign has been working pretty well. We've seen major companies that were dealing with Iran pulling out of Iran, fearful because the United States has basically said to these companies, either you do business with us or you do business with Iran. That's your choice. And because these huge companies, we're talking about Airbus and Renault, if we're talking about France, because their dealings with the United States are vastly larger than anything they're doing with Iran, the choice is not too hard for them to make. Unfortunately, we've seen the Europeans trying to carve out a strategy to undermine these sanctions, to get around these sanctions. They even tried to make it illegal for companies to withdraw from Iran. Now they're looking at some way of allowing companies to do business with Iran while skirting U.S. sanctions, some kind of barter scheme that they want to put into play. Nevertheless, I think so far the pressure has worked. We see the situation in Iran. The economic situation is not good. It's getting worse. And I think when the new sanctions kick in November 4th, we're going to see a further decline as far as the economic situation in Iran. So if the idea is to pressure this regime through economic sanctions, and we have to remember in international relations, we don't have so many tools that we can use in order to put pressure on a regime that's behaving in a way that other states are not happy with, it's working. The big question, of course, is how this will translate into getting Iran to get agree to a better deal in the nuclear realm.
Sticking with the lead-in and the lead-up to November 4th, you know, there's a big fight in the United States right now over SWIFT and over whether the administration can, and more importantly in a lot of quarters, whether the administration should really, really put the squeeze on the SWIFT system. Talk a little bit about that argument and give us a prediction about what you think is going to happen.
Well, I think cutting Iran off from the SWIFT system is very important. And those that favor the pressure campaign understand the importance of cutting the Iran off from the system. That's what was done in 2012 when the biting sanctions were put in place, which ultimately brought Iran to the table in 2013. It was an important part of the biting sanctions back then, and there's no reason to think that they will be less important now. So there's a lot of pressure to go that extra mile or to sanction those that are not willing to cut Iran off from the SWIFT system. It's hard to make a prediction how it's going to go, but I can say that this is an important part of a pressure campaign. If the idea is to put as much pressure as you can on Iran, then this is a big part of that campaign. There's pressure without it, but there's no reason, if that's your goal, not to do all of the steps that would be effective in that regard.
Right, and we should mention SWIFT, of course, is the way international banks communicate with each other and transfer money. It's right. The system used by the overwhelming majority of banks in more than 200 countries, so obviously an important way for Iran's banks exactly to be connected to the international financial system. Emily, I will make a prediction. I think Donald Trump is going to put the squeeze on SWIFT. And look, it looks like professionals of the Treasury Department are nervous about this, but Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, famously heading to the Middle East next week to both Saudi Arabia and to Israel, he'll be hearing a lot about this issue, and I suspect the Trump administration is going to come under, if it hasn't already, a lot of pressure to really, really ramp the sanctions up as high as they can. We know what the president's intuitions are. It would surprise me if he didn't take this step. Well, but time will tell.
Right.
On another front, no less important and maybe more important for Iran, this issue of oil. Emily, a headline that I thought was shocking. The Chinese are cutting their oil imports from Iran. The Chinese state oil refiner cutting its imports from Iran by half. I think in the month of September, that's in addition to South Korea taking their imports down to zero, India dramatically reducing its imports, and even some countries in Europe. This looks like it could really be a blow for Iran.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt. And, you know, there's a debate in the United States, of course, over sanctions and the pressure campaign. It's a replay of what we saw in 2011 and 2012. Those that, you know, are more, have a more favorable view, let's say, towards Iran are famously against the pressure campaign. Their argument is always, you know, pressure doesn't work. It's not going to lead to what you want. It can backfire. It can have all these adverse. There's a limit to what the U.S. can do alone, and Russia will step in, and China will step in, and India will step in, and they'll undermine the effect of these sanctions. But what we've seen over and over again is that's not actually what happens in the end. Empirically speaking, if we look back over the years to 2002, 2003, when this crisis began, empirically, the only thing that has had any effect on Iran's calculations has been pressure. It was in 2003 when Iran thought they were next in line for a war after Iraq. And that's when they, you know, put their military nuclear program deeper underground. And it was again in 2012 with the economic pressure. That's the only thing that has worked. So it's hard to understand the argument of those that are consistently against pressure and always fearful that it's not going to work the way you want. Again, it's international relations. We don't have too many tools to use in order to try to force a state to do what other states want it to do. We're working with imperfect tools, but in that realm, this is the only thing that has had really any impact. And therefore, yes, I think we're going to see that there will be pullbacks. And when November 4th comes, I think we're going to see even more in that regard.
You know, Emily, I'll share a quick anecdote. Back in September for our channel, I was doing reporting from South Korea, mostly on the North Korea issue, but also on South Korean policy toward the Middle East. I had an interview with the head of the Middle East desk at the South Korean Foreign Ministry. I asked him about Iran, and it's the first words out of his mouth, Iran is an important partner for us. And so I said, even because Iran is accused of hostile activity in the Middle East, I'm paraphrasing what happened, he says, we don't know of any hostile activity. So I said, Iranian support for Hezbollah, Iranian support for Hamas. At one point he said, let's turn off the cameras. It was an interesting conversation. I went to the Israeli ambassador the next day, asked him about what Iran means for Israel's relations with South Korea. He said, I remind my South Korean counterparts that there is a certain U.S. President Donald Trump who might take certain steps in the Iran nuclear deal. Of course, fast forward a year, South Korea's cut its oil imports from Iran to zero. And South Korea is a very, very significant customer of Iran. But Emily, as we've all been saying, so the sanctions work, what then? You believe that this will bring Iran back to the table?
Well, as I said, we're working with imperfect tools. This is what we have. Empirically, we know that pressure is the only thing that works. We're at a very late stage in the game. Trump came in and has turned things around on Iran 180 degrees. That's clear. But it's a very late stage. Iran is very advanced. Iran has the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear deal, which all the other partners are backing, each for different interests. It's not necessarily because they think this deal is going to stop Iran from becoming a nuclear state. The Europeans have economic interests. They want to get back to business. with Iran. For Russia, there are strategic interests. There's a rivalry with the United States. In other words, it's not because they think this is necessarily the perfect arms control deal, although, of course, that's what they say. And so Iran has, you know, they're trying to drive a wedge between the United States and Europe, and quite successfully so far, right? The Europeans feel that they were, you know, not treated well by Donald Trump. Donald Trump went on his unilateral path to pressure, didn't take them into account. So Iran is in a much better position now than it was back in 2012. So the task gets harder and harder as time goes by, as Iran makes advances. And of course, it's making advances also in the nuclear realm. We'll talk maybe in a bit about the issue of inspections at non-nuclear sites and what has not been going on in that regard. But in this imperfect situation, I think actually the Trump administration is taking the right direction. And hopefully this will translate into something more effective as far as the nuclear deal is concerned. But it's hard to say that it's going to work in the way that the Trump administration wants. As I said, it's late in the game. Iran now has new friends that are supporting it. Iran is more advanced. And that's why it's important to keep the pressure on and to hopefully go that way. But it's hard to make a prediction at this point whether it's going to work. The Iranians are likely, just as John Kerry, right, had these meetings with the Iranians, and what he was basically telling them was, is sit low, you know, bite the bullet, take the economic sanctions, hold tight. In 2 years, hopefully there'll be a new president that will be much more lenient with you. So they might try to, you know, go that route. We'll have to see.
So I say, take from what you're saying, basically, this is a gamble, but it's the best hand that the United States can play. You know, as for that strategy of waiting it out, it just strikes me as a very, very high-risk strategy for Iran. I mean, that also may be the best hand that Iran can play and be the best gamble that Iran can make, but 2 years is a long time when
especially
you're under this kind of economic pressure.
Predicting that Trump might...
And that's the other thing. There's a strong chance that this president will win re-election. Okay. One of the best campaigners in American history. One of the best marketers in human history. Whether one likes or doesn't like his policies or his style or even his character and personality. Very, very effective in the campaign trail. And I have to say, even if there is a Democrat who's elected, I personally think it may be hard to return the United States to 2013 and 2015 at this point. But again, time will tell. I want to go back to something you mentioned a minute ago, which is the issue of inspections. You know, Benjamin Netanyahu, every year, his speech at the UN General Assembly is a huge media event here in Israel, widely covered. And to this year's gathering, he brought, as usual, a prop, and it was that picture of the site in Tehran that Israel says the IAEA should inspect. And Benjamin Netanyahu calls from that podium for the IAEA to be inspecting. Emily, you think he was right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, the JCPOA is a faulty agreement. There are lots of holes there. There are lots of flaws. And one of the major flaws has to do with inspections. There are inspections at nuclear facilities, and then there are inspections at non-nuclear facilities. As far as the nuclear facilities are concerned, yes, the JCPOA has given more access to the nuclear facilities. But the truth is, it wasn't needed. The inspections, according to the NPT, were enough. We had full reports on everything that Iran was doing at its nuclear facilities before the JCPOA. What was missing? What was the thing that needed to be fixed by this Iran deal at the non-nuclear facilities? Because where was Iran advancing its military program? Obviously, at military facilities or other facilities, not at the nuclear facilities that they had to open to IAEA inspections. I mean, that was clear. And of course, Parchin, this military facility, is clearly where they were advancing a huge part of their military nuclear program. This was what was missing per the NPT, that the IAEA had no rights to demand inspections at non-nuclear facilities, because that's how the NPT is worded. So the deal was supposed to close that loophole, and it didn't do it. It has provisions that are convoluted and open to interpretation and ambiguous. And in the background, we have heard the Iranians before the deal was concluded, as it was being concluded, and after it was concluded, you will never gain access to our military facilities. We know that there was one inspection at Parchin in September 2015. And almost a year later, we heard that suspicious particles were actually found there. There was no follow-up inspection from the IAEA. We now, since the deal, we have very, very thin reports on Iran. We don't have the full reports that we used to have. We have very, very limited information. And there's nothing about whether the IAEA has asked for inspections and been refused, whether they're not asking because they're afraid they're going to be refused, whether they have asked and they have visited some. We don't have that information in the public
domain. So we don't even know, you're saying, what the IAEA has even asked to do.
We don't know.
We don't know if Iran has refused them.
All we get is these laconic statements, just like we got after Benjamin Netanyahu presented this evidence at the UN. The IAEA head, Amano, said, we've inspected what we need to inspect. That is not sufficient. We need to know where, when, what was found, what wasn't found, whether they've been resisting, you know, asking again, because, and there's a lot of speculation that that is the case. And so the whole issue of inspections, where we need to focus, is where Iran is likely doing military work. And that's what Netanyahu exposed, and his demand to, or his request to the P5 plus one to say, do something. Give the IAEA a stronger message that they need to go to those facilities. Why not?
So this wasn't just about this one facility, you're saying. This was about an entire set of working practices by the IAEA that you think the Israeli government is frustrated with. The question is, Emily, who can put that pressure on the IAEA? And what would be the incentive for that actor to put that pressure on the IAEA?
So it's a delicate situation with the IAEA. On the one hand, they're an independent agency, right? And they don't take instructions from anyone. But at the end of the day, they sort of do take instructions. Or they see how the wind is blowing, right? So it's not entirely an apolitical organization, even though it's meant to be. So the message they're getting, unfortunately, from the P5 plus one is not one of urgency that they need to get into those facilities. They're only getting that message from Israel that's showing evidence, a little bit from the Trump administration, but the others
Why only
could
a little bit from
less.
The Trump administration?
Well,
given
that's a good
the
question.
General positions that the Trump administration
That's a
taking.
Good question. There were there were statements that were issued by the State Department that the IAEA needs to ask what's going on with these facilities that Netanyahu revealed. But on the other hand, there were these strange reports about two senior officials that were expressing doubts about what Netanyahu had revealed, which was very strange. I mean, if they're current officials, of course, they were anonymous. We don't know who they were, but that whole story was a little bit strange. I don't have an answer for that. But all I can say is, in terms of, you know, what needs to be done, it's clear that the problem is not on the nuclear facilities, where you always hear the supporters of the deal always say, but look, there's so many more inspections. They're not needed there. The military or non-nuclear facilities, those things that have been exposed by Netanyahu from material that was taken from Tehran, we're not talking about intelligence, we're talking from the horse's mouth. There's no excuse for the fact that the IAEA is not taking a stronger approach towards those facilities. If the P5 plus one gave him a different message, Amano, I think it would change, but he's not getting that message.
So there's nothing under the nuclear deal stopping the IAEA from at least asking to go into those facilities and reporting on whether their request has been accepted or not.
Again, the provisions are very convoluted. You remember when we studied the text, it's maybe 24 days, but it can even be lengthened to more. I mean, the provisions are already problematic, and that we know. So even if they followed the letter of the JCPOA, they're not going to get in there immediately. But of course, there could be more pressure put on them and to say, look, it's urgent. I mean, if Netanyahu is correct, and I can't believe that he was presenting facts that were not clear and checked about the taking out the radioactive material, you know, and spreading it through Tehran. These are things that definitely project an urgency here that should cause a different approach on the part of the IAEA.
You know, Emily, we're about to move on to North Korea, but just one comment listening to what you have to say. Look, you as a seasoned deal opponent, this is supposed to be your hour to be ecstatic. Donald Trump was pulled out of the deal. The sanctions are being reimposed. On November 4th, the noose could be tightened even more. Benjamin Netanyahu goes to the United Nations with new evidence, but you're not optimistic. You think it's a big gamble. It's the best gamble that the United States can make, but it's still a big gamble that this whole strategy will work, that Iran will come back to the table. You don't seem all that optimistic that inspections will be ramped up.
You're right, because as I said, the more time that goes by, the more difficult this becomes. And the actors, you know, it takes a lot to get these international actors to do what needs to be done. And even the Trump administration, as we see with regard to the inspections, they're not putting the full weight of the administration behind this important issue, even though the Trump administration obviously has taken an approach. By the way, I didn't think leaving the deal was the best approach of the Trump administration. I thought more time and energy should have put into trying to what they call fix the deal, or what I call.
And there was so much progress on that too.
But you know, it's hard. There's a lot of interests at play. So even for the U.S. administration, there are certain restraints, and they're perhaps not going to go the full Monty, let's say, in the face certainly of all the resistance that they have from the other states. But it is the best gamble in town. It's so important. And as we transition to North Korea, I think it's important when we look at North Korea, when we look how the options are limited now on North Korea, how reversing the situation in North Korea is probably not going to happen. It's because North Korea was allowed to cross the nuclear threshold. So it's a whole different ball game. They're already a nuclear state. Trying to reverse that situation is tremendously difficult, which when we come back to Iran, means that it's so important to stop Iran before they cross the threshold. Because if Iran becomes a nuclear state, it will be like North Korea. And the ability to reverse that, to turn things around then, will be near impossible, just like it is on North Korea.
And let's actually move on to North Korea. You know, Emily, I was sitting at that press conference that Donald Trump gave in Singapore in June. He talked about Kim Jong-un as a man who wanted to transform his country, and that Donald Trump believed in his pledges to do just that. Look, it's not happening, okay? We're three months out of the summit. It's just not happening. On the other hand, there are no missile tests, right, as Donald Trump continues to point out. There is a continuing dialogue between the U.S. and North Korea. There's talk of a second summit. On a scale of 1 to 10, how's Donald Trump doing?
Look, I mean, the way I have analyzed this from the beginning, even though everyone's talking about denuclearization, it's like everybody knows denuclearization is not going to happen. But the United States can't talk about dealing with North Korea without talking about denuclearization. It's so embedded in U.S. policy that that's just, it can't happen. So it's like they're playing this game where they're talking about something that they know is probably not going to happen, when actually what they want is to reduce tensions. And that actually has been achieved. Think of where we were just a year ago, and the kind of rhetoric that we were hearing, and the threats that were being issued on both sides, and the missile tests. And there was a nuclear test last September. And this has ended, at least for now. I'm not saying that it's, you know, for sure it's not going to come back. But in terms of tension reduction, which is, I'm sorry to say, is probably the best that we can achieve at this late stage, because North Korea is a nuclear state. Not because I'm giving a free pass to North Korea and I'm being harsher on Iran, because the nuclear threshold is a significant threshold. Once you pass it, you're in a new game, a different game, and your options are severely limited. And so in that world of limited options, to reduce tension, to have, you know, relations between the United States and North Korea that are not characterized by this fiery rhetoric and threats that are being thrown at each other, you know, that's a good thing, and that was achieved.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, it may well be true that the president is overselling the success of the policy. He's definitely overselling the success of the policy, but I also don't think that we should belittle what has been achieved and what may yet be achieved, even if, as you're saying, what will yet be achieved is really more of the same, not really any progress toward denuclearization, but even not much progress towards dismantling many of the facilities. They've obviously have dismantled the Punggye-ri testing site and have said they'll allow inspectors to go check that out. But I agree with you that in terms of tension reduction, that's really the only realistic goal in the Korean Peninsula. And it seems that that is being achieved, at least for now. So Emily, again, this was great. Great to be back with you again. And this concludes our podcast for today. You're welcome to listen to all of the INSS podcasts by logging on to the INSS website at inss.org.il, where you'll see a featured section for all podcasts. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Owen. Thank you so much.